Thank you very much, Jennifer. Thank you all for coming this morning. I think we have a very interesting session ahead of us. There already have been many discussions of China in the conference so far and the Ideas Festival. More are to come. I think this one comes at quite an opportune moment because we have been discussing China as an economic power. We've been discussing it for its environmental impact. We're being examining some of its strategic and military ramifications of its growth. There are many other of these practical aspects of China's rise which we'll be considering during the Aspen Ideas Festival. The purpose of our session this morning is to ask what is underneath all of this in China itself? What is the cultural underpinning, the ideological underpinning, the moral situation of China that is manifested through these various practical signs, how its economy grows, how it deals with the rest of the world? The answer to that question of what there is to China itself, how China considers its present, how China considers its past, how it considers its future, its obligations to its own people and to the world, is of enormous consequence, not only obviously for the Chinese people themselves, but for all of the rest of the world, for the countries that China influences, which is to say, all countries of the world. We've already heard various hypotheses about how to think about modern China. We've heard people suggest that it is, in a way, an empty culture, where two centuries of turmoil have removed many of the underpinnings of duty and classical morality, and certainly of spiritualism. We've heard that China has been through a long period of rejecting one tendency after another. We've heard, on the contrary, that China's history is being brought back to life in a new and usable way. To help us understand these hypotheses and others, we are very lucky to have two speakers you've already been introduced to in previous sessions, and I'll just mention them briefly, and who are going to give their complementary perspectives on how to think about the tensions and trends within modern Chinese culture. Each of them will speak for 15 minutes, then we'll have some discussion here on stage, and then we'll certainly allow time for audience interaction too. Our first speaker is going to be Professor Du Weiming, who's now the Harvard Yenching Professor of Chinese History and Philosophy of Confucian Studies at Harvard University and director of the Harvard Yenching Institute. He has taught at just about all the fancy pants institutions you can think of in North America, in Asia, and in Europe as well, and is a particular expert in Confucian studies and the modern role of Confucianism. After Professor Du gives us his 15-minute introduction, I'll say a word more about Melissa Chu, who will then speak. So please join me in welcoming Professor Du Weiming.
Thank you very much, Jim. First, I would like to, I'm very grateful to the Aspen Institute and DHL for giving me this rare opportunity to share some of my still tentative ideas with such a distinguished group. I would like to also to appreciate Rodmar Farquhar and Li Chen for setting the whole context in the political and economic and diplomatic context for us to explore the question of culture. If we look at the world in terms of a cultural map, it looks somewhat like this. The largest is the Christian world, divided among the Catholic, the Protestant, and Eastern Orthodox. They share a great deal of common features, but there's also tension, if not conflict, among them. The Islamic world, often we focus attention on the Middle East, but the largest Islamic worlds are all in Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, and so forth. We do have the conflict between the Shiite and the Sunni. We have the Hindu world in South Asia and Southeast Asia. We have the Buddhist world spreading all around the world. We have the Jewish world, only with about 16 million people, but extremely influential. We have what may be called the English world down south, that's Australia and New Zealand, of course, Africa. But we also have the East Asian world, which is often characterized by Japanese as the Confucian world. Part of the reason is because in the 11th century in China, probably 13th century or even earlier in Vietnam, 15th century in Korea, and definitely 17th century in Japan. All educated people by the mid-19th century were seasoned in Confucian studies They knew the four books by heart. Many of them could recite it by heart. The four books consist of the Analects, the Book of Mencius, the Great Learning, and the Doctrine of the Mean. And this area shares some very important features. First of all, the Chinese characters, the language. It's a written language. If we want to understand it, try to imagine in the counterfactual situation, in the 17th century, all the major intellectuals in Europe use High Latin to express their ideas. That's true with Newton, with Leibniz, with Voltaire, and so forth. Imagine that High Latin continued to be the written language of the Western world. English, French, Spanish, German, with no written forms, the only spoken forms. And then you have something comparable to the Chinese situation. So it's possible for the Japanese, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Chinese to communicate, even though linguistically they don't share the same kind of, you know, spoken language. They can recognize these characters. They can communicate. One of the most recent examples was in probably in the 1960s when I communicated with the Japanese philosopher, Shimada Kenji. And I didn't speak Japanese that well, and he didn't speak Chinese that well, so we communicated by writing. And in fact, afterwards, we checked with some of the people who were bilingual. We managed to get through about 70 to 80%. The other one, of course, is the value. In addition to the form of life and also the elite, in the Chinese case, the so-called scholar officials, in Japan, the samurai intellectuals, in Korea, the yangban, meaning civilian and military elite, and also in Korea, and in Vietnam, the literati. One of the shared values of this particular area is learning. And learning as a character building, as a process of self-actualization. In fact, I can say the great strength of modern East Asia is its intellectual and spiritual self-definition as a learning civilization. This may very well be the most precious legacy of Confucian humanism in East Asia. If you take the case of Japan, in the modernizing process, learn from the Dutch, from British, from the English, of course, from German, and more recently, from the United States. In fact, the first character in perhaps the most revered Confucian classics, the Analects, is the word xue, which means learning. Learning to be human is a ceaseless process of self-realization. Confucius, in his spiritual autobiography, envisions his own life history, as a continuous process of learning. At age of 15, I set my heart upon learning. It's a direct quote from the Analects. At 30, I established myself. At 40, I had no perplexities. At 50, I knew the mandate of heaven. At 60, I learned to listen well, at ease. At 70, I could follow the dictates of my heart without transgressing the boundary of rights. In the Confucian perspective, not only a person, but a family, a community, even a nation, a region, and human species will have to learn. All human constructions, economic organizations, social structures, political institutions, universities, churches, even philosophical systems and ideologies are evolving processes. Without learning, they inevitably become stagnant. The Confucian literatus, in modern perspectives, can very well be conceived as the forerunners of the modern intellectual. As scholar officials, they assume political roles and perform their social functions through the bureaucracy. Like Indian gurus, they are teachers. Like Buddhist monks, they are ethical exemplars. Like Jewish rabbis, they are learned scholars. As Greek philosophers, they are wise people. Like Christian priests, they are spiritual leaders. And like Islamic mullahs, they are community leaders. Yet in the final analysis, their commitment to the improvement of the human condition rather than to a reality outside or beyond the world, such as the kingdom of God yet to come or the other shore, compels them to take on social responsibilities comparable to the ideas of modern intellectual. Confucian humanism, in an idealized sense, seeks to integrate four dimensions of human experience: self, community, nature, and heaven. Ideally, fruitful interaction between self and community, but community variously understood as the family, as the clan organization, as society, nation, and beyond. Then the possible fruitful interaction between human species and nature, and mutuality and mutual responsiveness between human heart and mind and the way of heaven. In this particular context, it is very interesting to know that tolerance is considered, especially religious or spiritual tolerance, is considered very important for the Confucian tradition and for China and East Asia as a whole. We normally talk about three teachings: Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. Ambassador Reischauer, a great scholar in both Chinese and Japanese studies, once made the observation that maybe 70% of the Japanese are Shintoists. 75% are Buddhists. When they are Shintoists and Buddhists, they never turn their back on Confucian ethics. So it's possible for a Chinese to become a Confucian, a Buddhist, and a Taoist at the same time. But in more recent years, let's say from the 15th century, when the Mongols invaded China, Muslims immigrated to China, and then Islam became an important part of the Chinese spiritual landscape. Christianity since the 17th century. So now we have to talk about the five religions or five teachings. Amartya Sen, as you know, my colleague, recently wrote a book, a very important book, called Argumentative India. And I think by contrast, I would say dialogical China or dialogical East Asia. In this sense, dialogical interaction begins with tolerance. But tolerance is not enough. We have to recognize the importance of awareness of the other. With awareness of the presence of the other as a potential conversation partner compels us to accept our existence, both myself and the other, with an ever-expanding network of relationships as an undeniable fact. This leads to the recognition that the other's role, belief, attitude, and behavior is relevant and significant to me. In other words, there is a possibility at intersection where the two of us are likely to meet to resolve divisive tension. With this sense of recognition, then reciprocal respect is possible. Only then genuine dialogue becomes a realizable goal. With genuine dialogue, then the spirit of mutual reference and even the celebration of difference become possible. And we can say that China exhibits a very complex situation. So dialogue doesn't mean China is integrated as a whole dialogical civilization. China is very complex, all kinds of contradictions. Sometimes people say China symbolizes a kind of restless landscape. We know the various kinds of regional variations, the urban and rural, the coastal area, such as Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. But if you look at the coastal area, the tension, the competition between Beijing and Shanghai is very important. People in Shanghai are not that excited by the Olympics of 2008. They're much more concerned about the World Expo of 2010. Shanghai leaders say, we want to wait to see if the kind of mistakes Beijing may make so we'll be able to correct them. And I just helped establish a Center for the Study of Confucian Entrepreneurs and East Asian Civilization at Zhejiang University. And there we study all kinds of Chinese entrepreneurs or business people. They talk about the ancient Chinese merchants like the Jing merchant of the Shanxi province or the Hui merchant, more recently merchants or business people from Taiwan, from Zhejiang, specifically from Wenzhou, and of course from Caozhou and so forth. Even universities, Peking University, Tsinghua, Fudan, and Zhejiang University are really involved in conflict and tension and competition, sometimes not very healthy competition. So the cultural dilemma China is confronted with now as a restless landscape is China, some people say comparatively, enjoys longest continued history together with India. But Indians are not that much interested in cultural continuity or historical consciousness. For example, Kalidasa, a great Indian poet, and many Indian scholars do not know which century Kalidasa lived. But Kalidasa is a great poet. There's a transcending perspective, whereas the Chinese are obsessed with history. For example, Confucius was born in 551 BC. That's historically verifiable. There was a major debate between two sides of the Taiwan Strait. The scholars in China insisted, according to our modern calendar, it was the 28th of September, when the people in Taiwan, so 26th, but now we know it's settled, it's 28th of September. So on that day, it's the Teacher's Day, now all in cultural China, not just in mainland China, but Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Macau. Even though China has the longest history, if you look at what happened since the Opium War of 1839, China has extremely short contemporary memory. You can even say amnesia, sometimes willful forgetfulness. Look at the current regime. We're not going to revisit the Tiananmen incident. The past is past. We look into the future. Very few people are deeply concerned in mainland China, not outside, about the Cultural Revolution or the anti-writers campaign. I'll give you one rather dramatic example. Peking University, we call it Peking University because they want Peking University in English, even in Chinese. It's called the Beijing University. More than 100 years old, which is considered very old in China. But if you look at Peking University at the May 4th period in 1919, and the Peking University under the Republican period, or the Peking University after the establishment of the People's Republic, and the Peking University in the Cultural Revolution, and the Peking University today after the reform and open, we're not only talking about a university. We're talking about many universities with different places, with different names, with different administrations, with different philosophies of education. So it's fragmented as many universities. As ruptures becomes the defining characteristic. And if you compare with some of the older universities, not only Harvard with 300 years, but with University of Paris or Oxford and Cambridge, Peking University, extremely young, and in a modern sense, very short memory. So the master narrative in China, which I think for the first time people begin to re-examine it, is the decline of China. From the Middle Kingdom, gradually it was reduced to a geographic expression. Then the rise of the Chinese Communist Party, the emergence of Mao Zedong with the revolutionary spirit, even the destructive power, total mobilization, and so forth. So the Communist experiment failed. Ironically, at a time when China was in terrible shape, 1968, the Chinese image publicly was the most brilliant. And some of the great intellectuals in the West, Jean-Paul Sartre, Michel Foucault, and Derrida, Julia Kristeva, or not only socialists, but Maoists. But once China became opened, and China, the restless landscape unfolds in front of all us, and then China's image very much changed. So we are now in this very intriguing and important period, and I hope in our conversation I will be able to return to some of the issues, both in terms of promises, in terms of pressures and conflicts. Thank you.
So Professor Du has given us a very rich introduction for our discussions here by talking about culture in one sense, the culture of religious traditions and moral traditions and the shared bonds across East Asia and the tensions around the world. We're going to discuss some of those in a moment. I just wanted to mention one or two implications of his talk. I agree, as a Shanghainese now, I agree entirely with him about the Olympics. We Shanghainese don't care about the Olympics. We are building for the Expo in 2010, so we all come visit at that point. Also, there is an aspect of modern Chinese culture I was thinking of when Professor Du was speaking. I asked him before he began whether he turned off his cell phone. He pointed out he did not carry one with him. If this had been a comparable lecture in China, his counterpart from the podium would probably not merely have had a cell phone and had it turned on, but taken one or two calls and answered them while speaking. So this is a demonstration of the differences around the world. Having now considered culture in the religious, intellectual, moral sense, we're now going to consider culture in a different sense, with a presentation by Melissa Chiu, who's the museum director of the Asia Society in New York and its curator of contemporary art. Just as Professor Du has been associated with all the fancy-pants universities around the world, so Melissa Chiu has been associated with all the very highfalutin museums around the world and art dealerships. She has firsthand experience in Hong Kong and in China and in Australia and, of course, in North America. So now she's going to give us her perspective on the identities, the tensions, and the trends in modern Chinese culture. Melissa Chiu.
Thank you very much, Jim, for that introduction. I want to thank Aspen Institute firstly for not just hosting, of course, the Ideas Festival, which is such an extraordinary event, but also these China panels or China Focus panels, which really give us an opportunity to see China in a different way from what we might be more familiar with through the various different media headlines. In fact, some of the taglines of most media headlines always really emphasize the rise of China. It's always about the rise of China and the cultural transformation. And my talk today really focuses on this idea of cultural transformation, which in many ways is at the heart of Chinese culture all throughout the 20th century. In fact, if we think of early 20th century China in 1910, we think of the New Culture Movement. It was a time when many serious scholars were sent abroad, mostly to Europe and some to other places like the United States, to learn about science, to learn about government, and the way that other countries and other cultures really focused. And this was a time when China was wanting to learn about other systems. Then if we think of course, the Cultural Revolution, from 66 to 76. This was a time when culture was at the forefront of everyone's thinking again, and it was a time when culture itself was being transformed in a very radical way. And if we look at many of those leading intellectuals and people in power today, their thinking and their belief system was really formed from this period of radicalization. And then if we think of post-79 and the opening up of China with Deng Xiaoping's open door policy, a new culture was formed, and that was one that embraced the change from a communist ideological system to a market-oriented system. And I wanted to speak a little bit today about how visual artists have often been at the forefront in terms of these kinds of radical changes. In fact, artists have often been premonitions of changes to come. If we think of 1979 and the first ever avant-garde group of the Stars, this was a group of artists who decided to band together and show their work in an unsanctioned exhibition on the gate outside the National Art Museum. This was in 79. It hadn't happened before since 1949 at least. And it was an unsanctioned exhibition. And, of course, the police reacted after hundreds of people had swarmed around and seen these artists' works. And, in fact, they were reported in... The exhibition itself was reported in Time magazine and other kind of international news agencies. Now, when the police responded by taking down the works, the artists banded together again and formed a protest, one of the first protests in this period. And they marched under the banner, "We mean democracy and we mean freedom." And I think this is a really important moment in Chinese history because it shows that there, here was this extraordinary moment of self-consciousness of artists also joining the debates around freedoms. And many artists were also heavily involved in the Tiananmen protests around June 4th. In fact, 4 months prior to the protests at Tiananmen, a group of artists show their work at the National Art Museum. And over 100 artists were exhibited, and this was the first ever time that these experimental artists had shown their work in a publicly sanctioned, that is a government-owned museum, and of course the premier kind of destination and legitimation for any artist wanting to prosper in that world was to show their work in the National Art Museum. Now, of course, what had happened was that during the opening, an artist decided to stage a performance by shooting her work. Her name was Xiao Lu. And she, in fact, she and her partner, Tang Song, were arrested. And this kind of outburst, if you like, of this performance alongside others and also a bomb threat to the museum was often seen as a premonition of things to come 4 months later at June 4th. Now, at Tiananmen, many artists were involved in the protests, and in fact, art schools, interestingly enough, were also part of supporting many of the people involved in that movement. In fact, the Central Academy of Fine Arts, one of the two premier art schools in the country, sponsored a sculpture which was later called the Goddess of Democracy. And this was an enormous white sculpture that resembled something of the Statue of Liberty in New York, but it was seen as an important kind of symbol for the movement at Tiananmen. Now, later in the decade, just prior to 89 and just after, many intellectuals often spoke about this kind of fever. It was often called leave the country fever. And many people left the country for residencies, fellowships at universities. And this diasporic community, especially after June 4th, in fact, many left with the intention of returning to China. And when Tiananmen happened, they were granted often residency and citizenship. In fact, the US granted 30,000 students residency and citizenship, as did Australia with 20,000 students. And so I think that this was, in time, a very important community, because when China limited the media around 89, what happened was that this community that had fled of intellectuals, artists, writers, and filmmakers, they became the voice outside of China, often speaking on behalf of mainland Chinese inside China. And as time went on, this community became a kind of, another kind of legitimate Chinese community, and many were settled in the United States in places like New York and also in other places like Paris. I think if you look at also how people survived after 89, especially those who played an important kind of role in the June 4th movement, it was very difficult. And in fact, the internet, and many of you might not know this, but the internet was used, especially in the visual arts, as a way of getting the message out of China. In fact, many curators, and especially leading figures like Li Shenting, who was the curator of the avant-garde exhibition at the National Art Museum that I spoke of before, he started up a website as early as 1994. And on this website, he began to stage temporary exhibitions where he would put up images of works. And these served as virtual exhibitions where he could actually communicate with his colleagues outside of China and show them what was going on inside of China, because at this time, of course, many people couldn't travel or they were prevented for various reasons. And so I think the internet very early on became an important forum for visual artists, and of course it's a much more important forum today. And then I think what we saw happen in 2000 was a very important watershed moment, because it was a time when the Chinese government decided that experimental avant-garde Chinese artists were okay. We saw an opening up, an internationalization of the Chinese art world inside China with exhibitions like the Shanghai Biennale. Suddenly they admitted international artists and international curators, and this was the first time after 89 that this was actually possible. And this went hand in hand, of course, with the Chinese government wanting to show experimental avant-garde artists overseas. And so we saw them shown at the Pompidou Museum in government-sanctioned international exchanges. Now, if we come to today and consider the importance of the diasporic community, we have not just the return of many. In fact, one might identify this as a bit of a gravitational pull back to China. In fact, many of those who settled outside of China have moved back. And if they haven't moved back, then they've certainly traveled with greater frequency to China. And in the case of artists, we've seen many of them establish studios. In fact, one artist who we are showing at Asia Society in September, his name is Zhang Huan. His story is an interesting one because he was a radical artist who came from nothing. His family situation is that his family was from Henan, and if you know anything about the provinces in China, the common analogy is that one must always be suspicious of those from Henan because it's one of the poorest provinces, and they're often the people who are pickpockets and various other petty criminals. And so it gives you a sense, though, of his beginnings. He was really born on a farm. He went to Beijing early in his career and studied at the Central Academy of Fine Arts. There he joined a group of artists and established the East Village, Beijing's East Village, an homage to New York's East Village. And they staged very radical performances that in many ways pushed the limits of what the government at this time in the early 1990s, after 89, considered possible. There were often performances that were about endurance in the tradition of performance art from the 1970s here in the US that always involved nudity and nearly always involved pain or some sort of pushing the limits of what one could endure. And one of his performances, one of the most famous from this period, was called 12 Square Meters. And he was living in extremely poverty-stricken circumstances on the outskirts of Beijing. And the story goes that he tried to go to the bathroom, the public toilets, one day, and he couldn't get into them for the rubbish around. And so he went to the next public latrine. And he was overcome in the heat of summer by the insects and flies surrounding him. So he then decided to cover his body with fish oil and honey and sit in the public latrine for 1 hour. And then he documented it. And I think this, yes, I'm getting a response from you of how kind of revolting the situation was, but I think it offers a very important commentary on how he felt at this time, both trapped, poverty-stricken, and also unable to show his work in Beijing and in China. In fact, the market for these artists' works in the early 1990s, up until 2000 even, was outside of China. Then, in 1998, he moved to the United States, and this launched his international career in an extraordinary way. He began to do large-scale performances in museums across the country, and in fact has now gained an international reputation to the extent that he's now represented by two major galleries, one in New York and one in London. And now, I talked about the gravitational pull back to China, he has established a studio in Shanghai with over 100 workers. It's a studio that has three buildings. It was a former garment factory, and he's been there for about a year, and he now produces works on the most ambitious scale that I've ever seen. And I think that this gives you some sense of the kind of trajectory that these artists have, and one might also say the trajectory of many other Chinese who settled overseas and have since returned with great success. Now, if we think of other artists who remained in China, I think that many of them have found much success. In fact, many of them have become something of entrepreneurs. We talk about artists in not often in that fashion, but I think that the kinds of studios that they're establishing, the kinds of international opportunities that they have to show their work, unseen around the world. In fact, I often say to Chinese artists that it's a great time to be a Chinese artist, because when you compare their circumstances to many of those who live in New York, you couldn't compare. They have enormous studios, sometimes twice or three times the size of this tent. They have people who work for them. And one also observes that as China is a manufacturing center in the world, so it has become an art manufacturing center. Now, what does this transition mean for artists from...
We should make this part concise.
Yes, exactly. Yes, okay. So I think that in closing... How does that sound? So in closing, I had one more point to make, and that was, with all of this that has happened for the art world in China, I think that one thing we must remember, and we often hear a younger generation of people speak to it, which is this issue of cultural pride. Many people speak about this period... I hope that doesn't count against me in my minutes. But so many people in China speak of this period as a new renaissance. They liken it to the Tang Dynasty, which is considered at the height of Chinese civilization and culture. They acknowledge the rise of China, but they acknowledge it in such a way that this is an important time for them to be acknowledged internationally. And I think we'll see other kinds of issues emerge around this idea of cultural pride. And I hope we get a chance to speak later about the cultural embargo that the Chinese are seeking on the import of Chinese antiquities in the US, because I think it has huge ramifications for our knowledge base about China here in the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Melissa. I'm going to ask a few questions of our panelists and try to find ways where they agree, where they disagree, where we can draw out some implications, and then we'll have time for questions from the audience. I want to start with Professor Du. You're talking about all the traditions China has drawn. It has Confucianism, it has Taoism, it has Buddhism. How about this as a proposition? If you spend time in modern China today, right now, you do not see much evidence of any of these. In the world of schooling, you see Confucianism in both its good and bad connotations. You see a good emphasis on study, a bad emphasis on rote learning. But many of these other traditions you're mentioning don't seem to have much practical effect on modern Chinese life. What would be the rebuttal to that hypothesis?
Two ways of looking at this. Yeah. One is the obvious. Mm-hmm. What we see in the last 10, even 20 years, I actually taught a course on Confucian philosophy at Peking University in 1985. If you look at this period, there's a real visible revival of the traditions. Certainly all the universities now have centers of Confucian learning and also classical studies. And according to one account, more than 10 million youngsters, roughly from 8 to 13, can recite portions of the four books. This movement actually started in Taiwan, and now in Taiwan about 1 million, but in China because of the size of the population. So that's visible. There are all kinds of visible signs. Another one is Kunqu. This is Chinese opera, which is now recognized by UNESCO as intangible world heritage. And it was shown in the last year or so 100 times and just overwhelmed, with overwhelming success. But I think more importantly is what we should call it habits of the heart. Mm-hmm. If people come to the United States and want to find Christian theologians, people who are very seasoned in biblical theological studies, it's difficult to find. But in terms of the habits of the heart, in terms of church going and so forth, that's different. I think I simply want to know, following Melissa's idea of cultural pride, some of these I would call cultural psychological resources. Mm-hmm. They're still very, very important. One is this ability to save. Mm-hmm. I think maybe 30 or 50%.
Yes.
And another one is overwhelmed majority of the Chinese are actually vegetarians, especially the peasants. And another one is the family cohesiveness. There's a whole study of the question of filial piety. Many young people say, well, filial piety has nothing to do with me. Then you ask the person, you say, look,
You pay some money to your parents on a monthly basis. How much you pay? Well, only 30%. So the behavior, the behavior is very different. And the idea, so there's a lot of very interesting situation. Another one, I think it's most visible to me, is this commitment to education, especially to learning. You can see of people of my generation and younger, they're willing to sacrifice their livelihood, in a way, in order to provide opportunities for the young. The Harvard Yenching Institute invites about 30 scholars from China on a monthly basis. Once you got selected, it's a great honor, a great opportunity. Sometimes we have people say, look, this year I cannot go. Next year is fine because my son is going through the entrance examination. I really have to help him out. Yeah. So many of these indications, marriage, for example, divorce rate is very high. But as compared to many other countries, it's relatively low. These are some of the examples, I guess.
Let me ask a question now, starting with Melissa, about a theme that ran through both of your presentations. Melissa talked about the cultural pride that was a feature of today's Chinese art. Professor Du was talking about the master narrative of Chinese history of defeat and humiliation 200 years ago and modern rise. There are examples around the world of national pride and sense of redemption having a healthy, harmonious, pacific implication, and there are also illustrations of nations becoming at their most aggressive, their most difficult when they're feeling on the way up. How do you assess those factors, both as you see them through the art world in China and as you see them in the other worlds of China, in the master narrative?
I think we have to say they have both positive and negative connotations. I think that on the one hand, we see enormous potential for China and as it sees itself in the world. I think that can only be a good thing. I think that, on the other hand, it can go towards xenophobia. And that's the worst case scenario. I think that right now, because China is on the rise and many people feel that way, they feel very positive. And I think that as China opens up increasingly and we find it becoming more international and cosmopolitan, I think that's where the rub will come.
And just to follow up there, is there a particular work of art you can think of recently that it illustrates this xenophobic, they're out to get us defensive type trend, or we're better than everybody else?
No. In short, no. I think that what we find more is the use of iconography that is very familiar. We see lots of panda bears. We see lots of Chinese flags. We see lots of images of Tiananmen, and even increasingly more, especially with surprisingly a younger generation of artists who never even experienced the Cultural Revolution, we see more and more images of Mao. And so I think that it's more about the kind of iconography that artists are working with rather than being able to definitely say, look, that's a positive or that's a negative message that they want to send. Right. Yeah.
The titter that ran through the crowd was both an appreciation of Melissa Chu's
art,
also a chipmunk was going right across
the stage. It's a little animal.
Yeah, so how about the master narrative of China's new rise after its humiliation?
Yeah, I think we can look at both in terms of phenomena and the implications of that phenomena. If you look at the phenomena following Melissa's observation, I think this process of internationalization and even some measure of cosmopolitanism. Even in 1985, when I gave that course, China, we normally believe China was very parochial. However, if you have students from Russia, the former Soviet Union, you have students from Africa, you have students from the Middle East, and also you have students from Eastern European countries. It's a different kind of cosmopolitanism, not like the cosmopolitanism in Cambridge. And so I think arts, music, and movies, some of the movies now are really difficult to fully appreciate, but also literature, these are being internationalized. But I think one thing, the negative side of it, is that China is just overwhelmed by a kind of developmental mentality. Therefore, materialism, commercialism, a lot of corruption. And in this sense, the humanities, what Aspen Institute is noted for, are being marginalized. and literature, history, and philosophy. Just imagine that the overwhelming majority of the Chinese college students are not exposed in the kind of functional equivalent sense to Plato, to the Greek tradition, to American constitutionalism, or to the philosophy of the founding fathers, or Jefferson, and so forth. But this is the hunger. I can see what I think Rahma Farquhar talked about. Because the ideological vacuum, there's a great earnest to search for cultural identity. I think cultural pride relates to cultural identity.
Yeah.
And cultural identity as identity politics is a double-edged sword. One is even some kind of fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. We can see Confucian fundamentalism for the first time emerging in China. Say, well, the whole society will have to be Confucianized. In fact, it should be a national religion. Mm-hmm. The Book of Change is such a wisdom book that all the great ideas are contained in that book. This one side of this. The other one, I think, is probably the mainstream. That is a notion about Chinese cultural subjectivity, which is pluralistic. The ideas the Japanese will have their cultural identity, and of course the Vietnamese and so forth. Because within the Confucian tradition, there's a lot of conflict and tension as well. The other one is a possible openness. And I think the most precious and the most difficult to cultivate is a kind of self-criticism, self-reflexivity. Part of the reason because the Cultural Revolution was so powerful in trying to force people to be shaped in a particular mold. So everybody is involved in self-criticism, involved in brainwashing. And so there's a kind of allergic to self-critical reflection. But I think a very healthy, pluralistic self-reflection probably will emerge.
This next question is in the mode of the snap quiz. We meet here today on July 4th.
Yes.
Because the United States is almost unique as an invented country, almost every American could say the idea of America is X, the meaning of America is X. The snap quiz is, what would be the right day to ask a Chinese person this question of what does it mean to be Chinese, and what would their answer be? Or what answer would you give to what does it mean to be Chinese?
You mean, sorry, just to clarify, you mean what I would pose to a Chinese person?
Yes, what you would think a Chinese person should say, but what's the meaning of China today? You know, people will say the meaning of America, well, it's democracy, it's individual rights, et cetera.
I think I would give two dates. One would be National Day, and the other would be Qingming. So they in some ways they offer the two sides of how people imagine themselves to be Chinese, either through nationalism or through more the traditional side that you've already spoken to.
It has to be a very short answer, right?
Yes, it does.
And actually, I edited a book called The Meaning of Being Chinese.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And I just want to note.
Yes.
Note, I think maybe 2 minutes.
Yes.
And in that book, the number of people contributed to that. I just edited it. And it's very interesting if you look at cultural China, not simply China as a developmental economy or as a politics, or as a political entity. There are three symbolic universes. One is being Chinese is linked to the Han culture, mainland China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Macau. The second one is the Chinese diaspora.
Yeah.
And since the Chinese diaspora, all Chinese constitute an extreme minority. Mm-hmm. I'm a Chinese American. And many people, Malaysian Chinese, Indonesian Chinese, Thai Chinese, Australian Chinese, there are all kinds of Chinese. And the third one is most intriguing. I insist upon it. A group of people who are connected with China neither by birth nor by marriage, you included. And they are very, very influential. In other words, they're Americans, Japanese, Russians, and so forth. They're very, very important in shaping the idea of being Chinese, which is important for the Chinese sense of self-understanding and the public image of what Chinese is or Chinese ought to be. This is not unusual. This is not exceptional. For example, the best study of American democracy still Tocqueville, who is French. And the best study, one of the most intriguing studies of the French Revolution was Edmund Burke, who was British. And some of the best studies of China, like Chinese Science and Civilization, is by Needham, Joseph Needham, England. And the classical Chinese study, the pioneering study of Chinese, classical Chinese by a Swedish scholar by the name of Kalgren. So if you involve all three dimensions, then being Chinese is, first of all, very complex. After all, you're talking about 1.3 billion people, right?
And you neglected only to say the classic study of the Shenzhen manufacturing empire is, of course, by America.
This is a new addition to that.
One or two more questions. Please move to the microphone. Here is one that puzzles me greatly. In traditional Chinese culture, as you see it in scrolls and paintings and everything else, there's a tremendous emphasis on connection with nature.
Absolutely.
If there's anything that characterizes modern China, it would seem to me war with nature.
Yes.
At least that's what most outsiders observe. We know, of course, Mao's teachings about man must conquer nature. How do you see this tension being reconciled before all of China is paved? I throw this to either of you.
I think he should be first on this count.
I think two ways. One is the emergence of perhaps the most powerful NGOs in China, starting in Yunnan, recently the riots in Xiamen.
Right.
And so I think this is something, it's not just environmental degradation, it's a question of health. I'm glad you're in Shanghai, but you pay a very heavy price. And the corruption really related to the local officials. The local officials are encouraged, sometimes pressured, to show their power of economic development. So they do everything, and the environmental issue is relegated to the background, very much in conflict with a very deep-rooted Chinese sense of, not just in the artistic sense of appreciating nature, but also the possibility of a dialogical relationship with nature. I think the situation is changing. Wen Jiabao may be the key for this kind of change. After the major flood, that was as early as 1988, deforestation of the upper Yangtze River was prohibited. No single tree should be this. Unfortunately, the automobile industry, which Beijing was a great bicycle capital in the world, now with only 3 million, of course only, with 3 million cars, with 13 million population, and Beijing is like increasingly like Bangkok, and like many other places. Shanghai is a little bit better. Even the beautiful city of the West Lake, of Hangzhou, the traffic jam is incredible. If this continues, and I think a number of people have predicted, if this continues, China would be in such an irreversible process of environmental degradation. And whether that can be stopped or not, I'm not sure. But I think with the collaboration of not just the central government, with all the local governments, they have to change the rules of the game. It's not simply your ability to develop, but your ability to develop in terms of green enterprises. And the situation may change gradually.
I just have one thing to add, which is I think that nature still has a very important role to play in the imaginary in China. That, of course, when we look at scroll paintings that you mentioned, they are natural environments, but humans in them are always very small. And then on the other side of things, when we look at Chinese gardens, they're not really natural environments, they're constructed environments. So I think with these two things in mind, it gives some insight to a Chinese psychological relationship to nature. I think that there are a number of initiatives, green initiatives, especially in the south, that I'm aware of, especially around architecture and sustainable buildings. And I hope that as things develop, these become the models for other buildings in China rather than some of the environmental devastation that we've seen.
For those of you who don't know about the car difference between Beijing and Shanghai, Beijing essentially lets anybody buy any car or truck, and Shanghai has a very sort of tight limit by auction of how many licenses they allow, and the difference is dramatic. Yes, please identify yourself and ask your question.
Yes, my name is Arturo Thompson. I'm a farmer from Arizona. And being a typical American, I know very little about other countries' histories. I've only read one book, and if you've read it, I'd like you to comment on it. It's good, bad, and different, or don't comment on it. Mao, The Untold Story. Are you familiar with the book?
Nope.
Oh, you can't comment. It's written by a Chinese now living in London. But
It's the
Zhong Chang
book. I know that book.
Zhong Chang.
Oh, you do know the book?
I do know
you. Oh, okay, thank you. I'll sit down.
I just want to mention one thing. If you know a few languages, you are bilingual. If you know two, you are multilingual. If you know two, you're bilingual. If you know one, you are an American.
That's not fair. That's not fair, actually.
Ouch. Try English person and Australian as well. It's the it's the blight of the English-speaking world. What do you mean?
And do you want to address that? This is a book was the opposite of hagiography about Chairman Mao, right, essentially that everything about him was evil, including his teeth that he never brushed for 20 years and they turned black. And so do you want to comment on the substance of the book?
Okay. I think the book that was considered more creditable was a book by Mao's physical physician,
a
private physician by the name of Li Zisui.
Yeah.
We have some doubts. Actually, he was that close to Mao. That's the story that he told. Mao refused to brush his teeth and all kinds of strange things. But now Zhang Rong, I think, probably didn't have any access to secret documents archives. She is so brilliant and managed to get all kinds of anecdotes. And to tell the story about Mao, normally academicians or scholars who are interested in the socio-political implications of Mao failed to recognize. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's very useful.
It was heavily discredited in the academic community.
And debated extensively. Yes, please.
My name is Tish Nettleship, and in this context, what I am is somebody who went to China at the invitation of Deng in 1979,
wow,
which was a very interesting time to be there. But I want to delve into the psychological aspects of the peoples running the country today who were raised during the Cultural Revolution. When I was there in 79, and when I was there later, and when I've seen some of these people in the United States, one-on-one, they're bright, creative individuals put in a room with other Chinese and responsibilities. The creativity completely disappeared. And I was told in 79, and again a decade later, that this had to do with growing up being a child when it was unsafe to have an idea because it would be praised one week as being a wonderful idea and helpful to the country, a contribution to China, and the next week your family might be sent to the provinces. I'd like to know how, when you grow up in that environment, what you see today in the people who run in the country that's left of that psychological feeling. And I'd like to raise the question to the moderator as well as to the rest of you.
Please, who would like to comment long-term intellectual, moral, psychological effects of the Cultural Revolution?
Just very briefly, I actually was born in China, but I grew up in Taiwan. I came to the States for graduate work. So I personally do not have that kind of experience. But in 1980, I lived in Beijing for a year. I was affiliated with Peking Normal University. I was fortunate to be given an office with my own key. So I was able to talk individually, small group, with the three famous classes after the Cultural Revolution, the classes of 77, 78, and 79. And I was just overwhelmed by the intelligence, by the idealism, and not to mention enthusiasm of this group. The first magazine they published, Underground, was entitled This Generation. So they're very conscious of the age cohort. And your description is absolutely right. The sense of personal psychological insecurity was so strong, you sometimes say you can only rely upon yourself. But this generation, I think at the time I predicted it, but I think even now, it's even more pronounced, is the hope of China. And however, you know, this generation, they experienced the worst of the Cultural Revolution when they were sent downward, working in the farming community in the worst possible situation, taking care of pigs and so forth. And many of them also become educated in the West, not just in the United States, but England, even France and Germany. So they've seen, in terms of the scope, their intellectual horizon, is something very difficult for us to imagine. And yet, they're very powerful. But they're somewhat influenced by the very deep-rooted Chinese psychology. The notion is that I'd rather be the head of a chicken rather than the behind of a cow. In other words, no matter how great that is, if I'm only part of it, that's not good enough for self-realization. I have to be the leader. So the notion is that for a group of Japanese to collaborate, this is natural. Japanese are group-oriented. For the group of Chinese to collaborate, it's a miracle. But the situation is changing very rapidly because now there's a real sense of security. There's a sense of collaboration. So we do see that happening at all levels, academic, business, and even in other social organizations.
Melissa Chu, do you want to add?
Just very briefly. Yeah. We're actually working on an exhibition right now on art from the Cultural Revolution, the first ever major show on this period. And part of our research has been to interview many people involved, not just in the Cultural Revolution, but also artists who worked during this period. And there are two major things that emerge from all of these interviews that I've observed. One is the loss of all belief, that for this generation, they believed so much in Mao, so much in what the party was saying. And this was a young, impressionable generation. And after that, when they realized that it wasn't true, it's been replaced by no other kind of belief system. So there's a real emptiness, I think, that a lot of people from that generation feel. I think the second thing that I wanted to say was also that although the situation was very hard in the countryside for many of those young people, they now look back on it as an extraordinary time of great freedom for them, with a great nostalgia when they were working with the farmers and they had surreptitious access to Western books. In fact, for many of them, that was their only education. So I think that there are these kinds of tensions that come with reassessing this period of time.
Thank you.
And to add my brief thoughts, I'm in this... The effect of the Cultural Revolution, there are many schools of thought about it. I'm in the school saying this is a profound individual and family effect that's difficult, still difficult for people to discuss in any sizable groups, except one-on-one. The closest analogy in the U.S. history, which is not very close, is the sense for maybe 5 or 10 years after the Vietnam War, that people who fought there had had a traumatic experience but were not free to discuss it. A very good book about this is Chinese Lessons by John Pomfret of the Washington Post, where he was at an exchange student at Nanjing University in the early 1980s with a lot of people who'd gone through the Cultural Revolution. It's a very good book. On the collaboration point, which I think is interesting, my wife's Mandarin teacher was telling her recently, you know, I rely on myself. I can only rely on myself. I noted in my classic study of the Shenzhen business enterprise that it's all a collection of very, very small businesses because nobody trusts each other. They don't feel as if they can collaborate. So China has many businesses, but none of them big, or very few of them big. Yes.
Okay, my name is Benton Kasman, and I did have the privilege of visiting China about 4 years ago, and set this up a little bit. Most of the discussions that I've been hearing as of late for China mostly involve the eastern portions of the country, Beijing, Shanghai, down to Guangzhou and that area, and there's a lot of history in Xi'an, you know, because of the Terracotta Warriors. But my question is, I hear very little about the areas around Kashi and Urumqi. And I was just curious what the current status of these areas, economic, cultural, and what kind of future plans did they have for these regions?
So we could give a brief interview of the Chinese rural interior.
Yes. The major enterprise now in China is to go west, the development of the so-called Daxibei, the great northwestern part. And if you look at China in terms of ethnic diversity, there's no question about 90%, maybe 95% of the Chinese are Han. They're very much centered around the coast and some big cities like Chongqing, Wuhan, and so forth in the middle. And ethnic minorities probably, according to the Chinese official calculation, about 55 ethnic minorities. They occupied more than two-thirds of the Chinese territory. If we look at Tibet, look at the Xinjiang area, the non-Chinese speaking Muslims as well as the Chinese speaking Muslims, we're talking about 10 million Chinese speaking Muslims and quite a few millions of non-Chinese speaking Muslims. And if you also include the Mongols, to a certain extent in the northwestern part of the Manchus. So that's the total picture in terms of the distribution of population. So this area is resource rich, and actually it also the source of Chinese water. So people are now, especially the leadership, critically aware, and that's the future. Without that kind of development, China would be in a pretty bad shape.
You want to talk about the interior, or I'll mention one interior point. The Atlantic Monthly, as always ahead of the story, had a big photo spread about a year ago. It was a picture of the railroad station in the Northwest, and the caption was, "Go West, young Han." Yes.
But thank now you. With the railroad all the way to Lhasa, the situation is changing again.
Then I think we'll have time for these three questions, if both the questions and the answers are as pithy as they can be.
Okay, my name is David Jaycox, and you touched briefly upon the film being internationalized. And since about 2000, several East Asian films have come over to this country that have made a very big impact, particularly Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Hero, both of which have, to me, very poignant stories that seem very relevant to the idea of Chinese cultural identity, but a lot of these films are coming from places like Taiwan and Hong Kong. But with all the talent like Zhang Yimou and Wong Kar-wai, how is China, or what steps are they taking or not taking to create their own film industry?
Maybe just very briefly, what is happening, we can see even a kind of process of democratization. And this is based upon, I think, the dialogical civilization. The Chinese, even though they're individualistic, they like to engage in conversations, to talk. And in Sichuan, you know, Deng Xiaoping's hometown, it's called Bailongmenzhen, which means to gather together in a tea house for hours and hours of conversation. And now if you look at internet, email, cell phone, and especially short messages, we do not use it in the States. But the short messages, it's something for information, for poems, for jokes, especially for political satire. Now, according to one account, 3 years ago, the income from short messages, normally just 1 cent per message, is so great, it's higher than all the print material put together. That's the income of the short messages. It's extremely powerful. So that's part of the dynamism within China. My sense is that dynamism is going to spill over to Taiwan, Hong Kong, and other places. So what you talked about, the possibility of some of those movies, some of those ideas that that eventually become international, is very good.
And I wonder if the two of you would each ask your questions, and then we can have our panelists answer them both and any valedictory thoughts they have. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. I'm Brian Dovey. I'm a partner in a venture capital firm. And matter of fact, I'll make it a multiple choice question. One thing that would help me is to, there's a certain view of China in the United States, and then of course there's the reality, to help me kind of reconcile that. I'll give an example. In our industry, we kind of nestled in Silicon Valley or in Cambridge and worked in garages and stuff. Now, I would say almost every partnership is talking about should we put a partner in China. If you read the program here and just do it by numbers, the sheer percentage of things on China. So the multiple choice is our perception of China and its importance over the top, about right, or never, not even scratching the surface?
Great. So while you think about your answer, we'll have the next question.
Should we just nominate the multiple choices because it's quick?
Okay, yes.
Mine is about right, actually.
Yeah. How about you?
I'm not able to answer that.
Okay. I'm with most of you. I'm also in the about right camp.
Yeah. But alongside others, like it shouldn't be just China-centric would be my vote.
Is the curriculum in the Chinese school system up to 12th grade federal or provincial, municipal, and what, if anything, is taught about Confucianism and the Red Guards or the Cultural Revolution?
Yeah, it's basically, I wouldn't use the term federal, but basically national. However, the situation is changing very rapidly. You have the standard texts. Right now, many of the so-called classical quotes are incorporated in the standard texts. But now the more important thing is the supplementary texts the students are encouraged to read and to expose themselves to. And these supplementary texts often are authored by professors from various kinds of universities. They all turn out to be very, very profit, very lucrative for these professors. So what we see is the overall centralization, but the centralization is no longer that powerful in terms of the overall control. So all kinds of initiatives emerge. Give you one example. In the last 4 or 5 months, one woman professor from Peking Normal University gave a series of 7 lectures on TV, and they were so well received, she wrote a book according to her lectures on the analects. And the book was so well, within 4 months, we're talking about 3 million, 4 million, broke all the records in Chinese history. It's a book on the analects. Just imagine Plato's Republic or a major book in Western thought suddenly became a bestseller. And even though her interpretation is subject to criticism.
Melissa Chu, do you have any unexpressed thought on this topic or any other you'd like to leave us with?
Just one thing, which would be, I think it's important when we think of China not to think in terms of progressive linear development. I think often we relate it to our own experiences, and I would just caution any idea of this transition from industrialization to modernization. It's important for us to remember that there's a whole idea of leapfrogging around, and one great example is telephones. Heaps of people in China didn't ever have landlines. They started with mobile phones. So I think that's just one example of we can't just generalize and think that the model of development in places like China will be like our own.
On that very valuable point, please join me in thanking Melissa Chu and Du Leiming.